Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Sonia's parents looked at each other across the dining room table. Sonia was discussing her plans to go to the exhibition soccer game with her chum, Jenny. Jenny's folks were going to drop both girls at the subway station Saturday morning and then pick them up later in the afternoon. "Well, you are 13, her mother began, "but I just don't know about your being in crowds these days." "But, Mom," Sonia began, "we've had tickets for this match for ages. I'm sure we'll be safe. There'll probably be police all over." "Maybe some creepy guys will be next to you," her 10-year-old brother added. "How will you know if they're terrorists or not?" he finished. "Are you sure you and Jenny have your subway route straight?" asked Sonia's dad, shooting her brother a warning look. "I'm not too thrilled about your riding the subway right now, either."
"Well, Dad," Sonia tried to smile, "at least we're not flying to the game."
"Hey," her brother piped up, inspired. "My friend's uncle opened some mail and his whole office got sick. Guess we're not going to go to the post office anymore, huh, Dad?"
From a parent's perspective, how can we best raise our children in an anxious world? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today is working with children and their parents, helping them handle stresses following terrorist acts on the United States. Dr. Patricia Carrington is a psychiatrist who works with children, adolescents, and adults in Maryland and with residents in psychiatry at the Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. She is the mother of two daughters, ages 9 and 6. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dr. Carrington.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
What are some of the traps parents can fall into with their kids in stressful times?
I think that one of the main traps that parents can fall into is not adequately dealing with their own anxiety around these events. And I think that that can play out in a variety of ways that lead to kind of other traps for them. Obviously, the events of September 11th and the subsequent events have raised all of our anxiety tremendously. For parents, not dealing with their own anxiety can lead to problems in their children because it can really affect their children in insidious ways. For instance, if parents are overwhelmed by anxiety, they may be extremely overprotective. They may flood their children with information and stimulation that is beyond what the child can cope with. Another way that this can play out is it can lead to underprotectiveness or, you know, a sense of detachment with the parents that can then lead them to not be observant of their children and the ways in which their children are exhibiting anxiety. Does that make some sense?
That's interesting. That's hard for me to imagine in this kind of anxious climate, parents being detached unless they're so preoccupied with their own anxiety that they're not sort of focusing on what's going on. Is that what you're meaning?
Yeah, I think that that is what I mean. The other thing is that with the extensive media coverage, people can respond to it in a variety of ways. I imagine everybody has been watching a lot of TV news, and my own personal reaction to it is that after a little while of watching it, I'm somewhat overwhelmed by the number of messages that I'm getting. Not only is there the person talking, there's the little tape going on underneath and people cutting in. It's really an overwhelming experience. One of the ways that we have psychologically of dealing with these kinds of overwhelming experiences is to sometimes become kind of numb and avoidant of it. So, you know, to sort of deal with the trauma of it, we may become kind of numb and detached. The problem with this, I think, with our kids is that we then may not recognize the traumatic aspects of what we have on the TV, what's on the car radio, those kinds of things. And we also may not be observant to traumatic reminders for our children or other kinds of behaviors that they may be exhibiting that may be signs that they're having some problems. One of the other things I think about the events of September 11th is that initially, you know, for the first couple of weeks, there was such an outpouring and overt recognition of what was happening, you know, not only in our daily interactions with people, but schools, communities, and all of that. That's been diminishing some with time and will continue to diminish. The level of support that that provided for everybody early on was crucial, I think, and really helped people sort of integrate the experience. But this period, I think, that we're sort of entering into now where the risk is ongoing, but perhaps unclear. Things happen that we're worried about, you know, is this related to terrorism or not? Sort of the further integration of the traumatic experience is, I think, a real high-risk period for people to have difficulty, sort of this 2 to 6 month time frame. And it's a particular time, I think, that parents really need to be alert to symptoms of difficulty in their kids.
How can we tell if our children are feeling anxious and yet not talking about their own worries?
Well, you know, kids have a limited repertoire with which to express difficulty. It's one of the problems with diagnosing ADHD in kids, because overactive squirrely behavior can be the final common pathway for lots of different difficulties with kids. And it's similar when you think about trauma and how kids respond to trauma. So for preschoolers, you know, kids under five, you really need to be looking for regression, which means kind of going back to an earlier developmental time. So, you know, they may want the bottle again. They may start to suck their thumb again. They may want to sleep in your bed. They may regress and sort of not use the potty anymore after they've been using the potty. They'll act like a younger kid. They may have more nightmares, be more fearful. You also may see an increase in temper tantrums or aggressive behavior and things like biting, which is kind of a combination of aggression and regression. In school-age kids, you know, they are much more involved in their social world. So what you may see in them would be also some regression, that they kind of get more clingy and want to be home more, a little bit more withdrawn from some of their social outlets. Some of them even refuse to go to school, which is a pretty dramatic and important symptom to pay attention to right away. They'll be irritable, mouthy, just verbally oppositional with you. And they may have trouble kind of sticking with their schoolwork, trouble concentrating. Adolescents are the most involved in their social world. And what you see with them may be, you know, that they're skipping school or their grades are dropping. You may see that they're arguing with you more. They're just more difficult. They're challenging you about every little thing. You also may see an increase in risk-taking behavior or substance abuse. And this is sometimes, for adolescents, a really important way that they have of important yet maladaptive way of coping with anxiety. It's kind of a way to deny that they're anxious.
It's interesting because what you're saying is a pretty good description of how teenagers behave.
Anyway.
So I guess what you're suggesting is we have to watch for the change.
Exactly.
If they're worse, doing it in a worse way or a more extreme way.
Yeah, you have to know your kid and be alert to, you know, how your kid tends to respond to difficulty, stressors, transitions. So it's being alert, and it's being alert to changes. It's also being alert to what are potential traumatic reminders for kids, because it's often around those times that they may have difficulty. You know, for instance, my husband had to travel this weekend for the first time since September 11th. And my 9-year-old daughter was just a pain in the neck that morning. You know, nothing, breakfast wasn't right, she didn't want to get dressed. It was just kind of one thing after another. And it wasn't until we kind of put together that maybe she was nervous about Daddy going away and could talk about that and talk about the fears and you know, and also reassure her about what things were in place to try to ensure air safety, that she was kind of able to settle down and put it into words in a way. And I think that that's kind of what we want to help our kids do, is put some of these fears into words and demonstrate that we're able to tolerate and accept the fears, not be overwhelmed by them ourselves, hear them, you know, hear the wide range of feelings that they have and that they talk about. And that's where I think modulating and dealing with your own anxiety is so crucial, because you can't do that if you're too anxious yourself.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on raising children in an anxious world.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Patricia Carrington about raising children in an anxious world.
It's interesting. One of the stories that I heard very close to the original tragedy was a story of a child who was a preschooler. So his verbal repertoire wasn't large, but he was playing with blocks in his house, and his mother happened to be in the room. And what he did was build a very tall tower and then take his toy airplane and crash it into the tower. And his mother said, "Why are you doing that?" And he said, "Well, that's what airplanes do." So she fortunately was smart enough to use it as a teachable moment. But I was thinking that there's not only with adolescents, who sometimes use bravado to cover up their feelings, but the little ones who really don't have the verbal repertoire really need some time to be helped with that.
But you're cautioning us against saying, "Oh, don't worry, everything's going to be fine." That's not the response.
I think that we need to be realistic with kids, that, you know, yes, this is a scary thing that happened. Yes, everybody is nervous about it, and things are kind of uncertain right now. These are the things that we're trying to do to make us feel safe, to make you feel safe, particularly. I think we can't be Pollyanna-ish about it. Kids aren't going to believe you anyways, you know, if you just totally write off the risk or the fear, the danger. But it's helping the kid contain it and helping them realize that, yes, though it's a scary time, the world's not going to end, we hope.
Well, that goes into our another question, and that is, how do we explain to them, with all these things happening around them, how bad things happen to good people, to paraphrase a lovely book?
You know, I thought about that question a lot in preparation for this, and I don't think there's really any good way, to be honest with you. We try in different ways, and even adults with our grown-up methods of coping have a hard time with this, right? And we frequently turn to religious beliefs for support. But there's also, I think, some other things that you can do with your kids. One is acknowledging, again, the awfulness of what's happened, but also pointing out some of the good things that happen out of this, like with the recent events, the surge in national pride, people really coming together, people thinking about kind of what's important in their lives again and making changes to indeed make those things more the center of their lives and more important. Those are all good things that come out of these kinds of things, the heroes, you know, the acts of bravery.
It's interesting that the superhero dolls that are being sold now are firemen and policemen.
Yeah, they're real heroes.
Instead of Spider-Man.
They? Yeah, they don't need any special powers, right? It's very nice. And I think is part of it, too, is also, you know, a sort of a renewed emphasis on whatever your own family rituals are, you know, how you celebrate birthdays, how you celebrate holidays, is again, one of the things that can help kids realize that not everything that comes out of such an awful event is terrible.
Dr. Carrington, is there a group of kids who are most at risk that we should really have our antenna up for?
I think that there are several groups who are at high risk and who need particular attention and a lower threshold for seeking professional help. Obviously, the first group would be kids who had any kind of direct loss or direct involvement in the events. But kids who had pre-existing difficulties with anxiety, who had separation problems, obsessive-compulsive disorder, worries about germs, you know, in the era of anthrax, would be kids who might be more at risk. Also, kids who have difficulty managing their own angry and negative feelings. You know, that's a large part of the population that we deal with as child and adolescent psychiatrists. But those kinds of kids may be particularly overwhelmed by these overt displays of aggression out of control and may feel even more fearful of what may happen if they lose control. The other group of kids is kids who are not adequately buffered from the events, either, you know, because the television is on too much or the radio is on too much or, you know, their parents are so anxious that they're not really able to adequately buffer the child, or kids who are exposed to violence in an ongoing way, either because of where they live, the particular community in which they live, or because of events in their family that are dangerous or threatening to them, either physically or emotionally.
In the news, of course, we read the term post-traumatic stress syndrome. Does that apply to children?
Absolutely, it does. Most of the work with children around this disorder has been kids, again, exposed to natural disasters or war-torn areas of the world. Also, kids who are raised in environments that are particularly violent. And there are three main symptoms to look for in post-traumatic stress disorder, and they sort of break down into three categories. The first category is intrusion, and this is where thoughts of the traumatic episode kind of intrude into a person's mind. The most classic example being flashbacks, where a person really feels that they are almost reliving this experience. But it doesn't have to be as dramatic as flashbacks either. It can just be ruminative or repetitive reminders or memories of the event that, again, really interfere with a child's ability to engage with their outside world. The second main symptom is avoidance, which you can best understand as the child's way of defending against the intrusive thoughts. It can lead to a kind of a detachment from the traumatic episode. And this, if it really goes on a long time, can lead to depression and sort of a shutting down of the child. And depression is frequently a condition that coexists with post-traumatic stress disorder. And the third cardinal symptom we call hyperarousal, which is where the child is highly tuned to respond to any kinds of fearful stimuli in an exaggerated manner. So these are kids who startle easily when you walk into the room or when you tap their shoulder or something like that. You can see that if these symptoms became excessive, that they would really interfere with a child being able to concentrate at school, to have a good time with their friends, you know, to do the developmental tasks that are necessary for them. And they would be an indication of need for intervention. And interventions do exist for post-traumatic stress disorder and usually involve several different modalities, from psychotherapy, which can be not only talking about the traumatic episode and helping the child process it, but also develop coping skills, relaxation methods for dealing with the intrusive thoughts and sort of shifting them into thoughts that they're better able to handle. Medication is also something that at times is used, and family therapy to help the family minimize exposure to ongoing stress and violence and support the kid's development. I think that we have to have ways to cope with our own anxiety ourselves. I mean, I think the parents need sort of protected adult time, especially parents who have younger kids around. They need protected adult time to talk with other adults about it, to sort of replay, you know, their story. I mean, how many stories have you heard about September 11th, right? And that's a way that adults have to process the trauma of what happened to them, where they were, who they were with, what they saw, all that kind of stuff. Similar to how kids work out the trauma with play often, you know, it's a way for people to get mastery, a way for kids to get mastery, and sort of talking about it is also a way for adults to get mastery over the events.
I'm curious about the term protected adult time. I don't think we've ever used that.
What I mean by that is a time away from your kids to talk with other adults, you know, your spouse or whatever, where you can express what it is that you're going through and feeling about the current events without that added layer of needing to protect somebody else. And I think that that kind of protected space, you know, is part of what happens in therapy, right? There's a protected space there that allows people to feel things that they perhaps would not feel in everyday life, and it can be difficult, and it can be, you know, a time where you sort of really take a step back, perhaps allow yourself to regress, but it kind of then allows you to go forward with a new understanding or new skills to cope with something. And I think protected adult time is sort of similar. You know, it's time with your friends, people that you like, you know, where you can kind of let your hair down about some of this stuff and think about how to cope with it in a way. It refuels you in terms of being able to deal with it with your kids.
Yeah. It sounds like that's an essential ingredient in an anxious time for parents. It's sort of like some vitamins. It enables you to sort of regroup and move on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the demands now are, in addition to reinforcing our family rituals and spending time with our family, you know, you need to have that time to yourself. You know, we need to be exercising, sleeping well, you know, trying to sleep well, eating well, you know, again, having outlets that are enjoyable and fun, time with your spouse, those kinds of things, you know, I think are very reinforcing and, like you say, vitamins for people to kind of help them face other scary things that are happening and help us support our kids.
We always stress the importance of parents relating to other parents. So this ties right in with it. You still need that support group of your own peers.
You probably need it more right now.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on raising children in an anxious world.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parent's Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Patricia Carrington about raising children in an anxious world.
In the tense emotional climate that we're living in, we've talked about what parents are in need of. I guess it's time to talk about what children are in need of. Dr. Carrington, what would you recommend?
I think that we have to remember that kids are developmentally self-centered creatures, which means that they are most affected by what affects them directly. So routines, consistency, regularity in their lives across the developmental span is really important, I think, during this time. Not only is it important for us, you know, but it's also important for kids to make sure that they're getting the sleep they need and those kinds of things, that their life is going on. Older adolescents and adults have a much greater understanding than younger kids of what the world implications or the future implications are of these events. But even older adolescents, middle and older adolescents, really benefit from this kind of, you know, routine and regularity in their lives that I think can be very important. But obviously with those older adolescents, it's also important to be open to talking about some of the uncertainties and what some of the implications are perhaps for our world. Again, that attitude that you're not going to be overwhelmed by this, by their fears, is so crucial. It's providing that holding environment for kids that hopefully, you know, we do for our kids all the time, right? But during this time, it's even more important to do that.
What kinds of activities can families do at home, assuming they can get their kids to do them, to help reduce the stress that the children are experiencing?
One of my daughters had a birthday about a week after September 11th. You know, to be honest, I was not feeling a whole lot like
celebrating.
Yeah, like celebrating. But my husband and I really decided that, you know, we didn't need to go overboard, but we needed to really make a nice family event out of this. And so, you know, we got a cake from our favorite bakery and we made a dinner that we all really liked. And it really helped us kind of remember what's important and reconnect in a way and defocus from some of what was going on in a way that was very helpful. During holiday time, it would be important also to reinforce your own family rituals and communicate that message to your children that things go on, that you are a strong unit that loves each other, that has a history and a past, a present, and a future. I think those are things that are incredibly helpful to children. The other thing is, you know, again, things I've said before, but exercise routine and allowing them to express their fears, though reminding them that, you know, most people do survive disasters of all kinds and that they themselves, you know, as much as you can assure them, are safe and that you'll do everything you can to maintain their safety and continue their safety.
It's interesting. I think there was a study that came out shortly after the Holocaust, a very long time ago, that showed that children could withstand a tremendous amount of trauma if they had their parents with them.
Parents can be tremendously effective at buffering their kids from these kinds of world events. Interestingly, in my practice, the kids are not talking a whole lot about this. There is one child that I've worked with who was somewhat directly affected in that she was on an airplane that day that was diverted and had to spend a couple of days in a city far from home, and it was unclear how they were going to get home and all of this. And that child is much more anxious about it, ruminating more about it, thinking about it, but she was directly affected by it. My sense is that the other kids in my practice are being well buffered by their families and their schools to cope with this.
We're all feeling like bunkering a little bit. That's sort of the general sense. How significant is it to get out of doors?
I think that's really important. I hadn't really thought about that specifically myself, but a couple of weeks ago, our family went out hiking, one of the local parks around here, and climbed up, and it was wonderfully peaceful and detached and quiet up there. And I certainly felt it, but my daughters, my husband also felt it. I think it's very important, you know, the beauty of nature, the beauty of the world. There are things that are constant and don't change despite some of these difficult things that happen.
How can we tell if a child is showing reactions to anxiety and problems in the world beyond what is considered, I'll put this in quotes, normal? When do we know if a child needs maybe some professional advice and counseling?
We talked a few minutes ago about what some of the signs may be of how kids will react to this and what some of the developmental differences are. What you should be seeing over time is some steady improvement, though understanding that there's going to be a waxing and waning of these things, that sometimes kids will be more upset. If they have a reminder of something that's happened, they may be upset and kind of rattled for a few days. But you should be seeing sort of a general improvement, and also that the child is not excessively isolating themselves from their peers, their routine, and from the thrust of their development. Certain things that you might see that would lead you to seek professional advice would be for a preschooler, really severe regression, with the kid really not being able to kind of come out of that with appropriate support and sort of understanding on your part. With a school age kid, a child who really withdraws from their friends, you know, despite your encouragement that they continue those interactions. And also, you know, kids who perhaps refuse going to school, you know, can be also a very severe presentation. For adolescents, a real increase in risk-taking behavior or real sharp increase in your amount of conflict with them. The first line of intervention would be some of the coping that we've talked about today and ways that you can kind of support your own family. But if these things really go on in a way that you feel is really negatively affecting your relationship with the kid or impairing their functioning, then seeking some professional evaluation and guidance would be important.
Now, of course, the next question is, how do you find the person to bring your child to?
Yeah, I think that there are a few ways. And I almost always advise parents that their pediatrician should be their first person that they approach in terms of trying to get some help and understanding what the mental health resources are in your particular community. In some of the communities that will be hearing your program, you know, they may not have adequate child and adolescent psychiatric services to deal with the kids that are symptomatic. However, there are other non-medical professionals who are very well trained and can be helpful in assisting kids in overcoming these traumas and difficulties.
What kinds of professionals should parents look for then if medical professionals are not available?
Psychologists, PhD psychologists, or licensed social workers can be very helpful. They can also contact their local medical society. And one of the resources that I'll give you is the National Organization of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry that has some geographic referrals available and can really help parents sort through what are, quote, normal reactions to stressors and what are indications that more support is needed.
Is there an 800 number or a website or something that parents can access?
The website is www.aacap.org. And the phone number in Washington is 202-966-7300. But the website is really full of a lot of developmental information for parents and has many useful links to other websites that I think are very helpful.
Well, we want to especially thank you, Dr. Carrington, for coming in and giving us and parent listeners all over the world your insights about how to raise children in an anxious world. Thank you
so much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.